Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
To the Total Celebrity Show special, Just Two Choices Celebrity Segment. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus, Neil Haley, and also at Periscope, at Total Tutor. And I'm just really excited about this. This is a definite high vibe thing. The guest we have today is a childhood favorite of mine, and I'm so excited. So I'm first going to introduce my co-host for the Just Two Choices segment, author Rico Rakowski. Rico, how are you, man? And thanks for coming on the show and having this awesome segment.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege, and Neil, and it's an I feel like you do. It is an absolute honor and a privilege to be here with Orson. So great blessings, absolutely.
All right, so go ahead and introduce our guest. I'm really excited for our listeners to know.
Yeah, well, thanks, Neil. And I'm really excited to have the guest with us today from the Denver Broncos, three-time AFC Championship player, three-time Super Bowl player, and part of the legendary AFC Championship comeback game, so to speak, known in the Denver Broncos history book simply as, from the phrase, the drive. Number 89, tight end Orson Mobley. Orson, thank you so much for joining us today, and it's a privilege to have you here.
All right, guys. Thank you for having me on. Well, absolutely, Orson. And the memories I have of you playing, me wearing my Denver Bronco jacket, living into school and getting ripped every year, and then saying, you know what, they're not going to do anything. And every year you guys got to that Super Bowl. And but again, what a tremendous memories. And I know, Rico, you've had some great memories of Orson as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Orson, I actually remember I remember the drive. I was watching it on TV, and there you were, 1986 against the Cleveland Browns, 5:32 left to play. The Browns leading 20-3 in Cleveland, and that botched kickoff, and you guys are on your 2-yard line, and that 98-yard drive begins. And it was year number one in the NFL, and you were already averaging over 15 yards of reception, and you know, playing with greats like Sammy Winder and John Elway and Mark Jackson and stuff. So could you just share with us what it was like to be part of that, to like fresh out of college, first year in the NFL, just share some of those feelings?
It was great. I had to kind of, after the season, kind of look back and realize how special it was to be a rookie and to be able to participate on the team and then actually, getting to the Super Bowl my rookie year. So it was a great experience, playing with some great guys as well.
How did a lot of people tease you with that, being your rookie year, and here you are, stepping into the AFC Championship game, stepping into the Super Bowl. Did you get some ribbon for that, or?
Like I said, I was a little too naive to know how big a deal it really was to be in that position. And, I just kind of went out there and did what I normally do. Being from Florida and playing up in Cleveland, it was very cold that day. And I think the first play, I got offensive interference, which I don't think it was an offensive interference. And then the second play, I jumped off sides. And so Coach Reese had to have a talk with me about, hey, this is to go to the Super Bowl. I know it's real cold, but, you got to play through it. But it was freezing.
Shot when you were down so much? Do you think that did you trust in John Elway? Orson, that this was going to happen, that you guys were going to win, especially when he was in the huddle and you're at that point and you have that many yards to drive?
Well, throughout the years, John has, he just kind of made some great plays and came back on some games to help the team win. So when he said, we got him right where we want him, I believed him.
Well, and you believed him, and it happened, and the rest is history, Rico, for sure, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. And And, you know, one of the questions that comes to my mind, Orson, that's kind of associated with that, you know, you talked about that, you know, being a little quick off the line there in that championship game. You know, as you know, a lot of people talk about what a quantum leap it's like to go from college football to pro football. And not everybody can make that leap. And yet you were able to make the leap to the pros very naturally. Could you share with us maybe some of your unique positive experiences that helped you make that quantum leap from college balls to pros? Like, for example, did you have some mentors in college who were already kind of prepping you for the pros, or, you know, someone who told you how to, you know, to make that drive to succeed within you, to make it work? Did you have that kind of, some kind of mentor there?
No, my, you know, my story is a little different from a lot of guys. And, you know, it's kind of the thing I have passion about, you know, guys look at, or fans look at, you know, athletes as being these special people, or, you know, guys that are put on pedestals because of their ability. And, you know, they look at some of the things they do and some of the mistakes they make, and, you know, they say, are they crazy, that kind of thing. And I was one of those guys that made those mistakes. And, you know, I didn't really reach the potential I could have reached as an NFL player. Some of the things that happened to me early on, like in high school, you know, I didn't really have a mentor as a coach. They pretty much allowed me to do what I wanted to do. I played three sports in high school. I played football, baseball, and basketball. And, you know, I was All-American in football and baseball. And basically, you know, my school allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do until, you know, until my senior year in sports was over with. And then they kind of, you know, stopped looking out for me. So when I got to college, you know, I had this misunderstanding that, hey, you know, they cared about me, so they let me do what I wanted to do. And then I got to college, and, you know, Bobby Brown was like, hey, you know, there's the rules here. You need to do this. You need to do that. And, you know, then I just, you know, I kind of figured that he didn't like me. And plus, after I got injured, he made me quit the baseball team at Florida State. So, you know, I didn't stay at Florida State for 4 years. I only was there a couple of years. You know, flunked out of school, ended up going to a small school up in West Virginia and playing for Bobby's son. And what prepared me for the NFL was I looked back at my childhood. We grew up very poor and in a rough area. And my motivation was, you know, sports was it. And, you know, I've kind of blew it with Florida State. And I have another shot here up in Salem, West Virginia. I better make the most of it. And I think more of my talent than anything else got me through.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you know, looking at your background, Orson, did Coach Bobby Bowden, he must have seen something special in you. I mean, to recommend you to go up there to Salem and play for Coach Terry. Did you feel that kind of a connection, maybe?
No. You know, me and Bobby had kind of fell out. You know, I was the problem child, and, you know, he gave me all the opportunities he could to get up there. And I think the Salem situation was they already had a couple guys up there from Florida State. And, you know, I was looking at maybe even going baseball at the time, and you know, I got a call from Terry called me and said, hey, you know, if you want a shot at the NFL, you know, we've got a couple guys who've already, you know, the pro scouts know about Salem College. We had a guy drafted late round, one went as a free agent, so there's a few teams that know about us. You'll get looked at. And so he said, you know, I take care of you if you come up here. So, you know, it was a big drop off from playing at Florida State and riding on planes to Gain and playing at Salem and lying in a van. So,
Well, you sure did well up there. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah. So I was going to jump, Rico, into the question I have for Orson is that after making the mistakes you made at Florida State, how did that lead you once you got to Salem, your second shot? what kind of gets you the focus? You wanted to play baseball. You went to a smaller school and still had that shot for the NFL.
Well, I think, like I said, I kind of realized, you know, my golden opportunity was up because, you know, they were looking at me. They were looking for me to promote me as an All-American at Florida State that following year. And, you know, and I kind of blew that, and it was like, you know, this is it right here. So I kind of, Salem even tried to get me to play baseball up there, and I just, and basketball, and I just kind of focused on football. Nobody really had to make me, you know, do the extra things I need to do. Like when I went home, you know, I made sure I was in great shape. When we went on vacation from school, you know, I made sure that I continued to work out and stay in good shape because I know I kind of figured, you know, this is it. And if I don't make, if I don't get a shot from here, you know, I may not get another shot. So I think it was more of the self-motivation of, you know, desperation, you would say.
Okay. The desperation and Rico, you talk about that a lot, right, Rico? About when you're at that point, right, Rico? Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, thanks for that thought there, Neil. Yeah. Orson, there's a thing that we talk about when we talk about choice on the show here. We call it just two choices moment, meaning that you could have done one thing or done something else. For me, I came from a small coal mining town in Pennsylvania, and the guidance counselor told me that I couldn't do something as I was walking out the guidance office door. And I said, and it turned out to be my career. I'm a pilot. But my point being is I was walking out the guidance office door, the guidance counselor said, "You're never going to do that." And I wasn't upset at all. You know, she told me what she thought I should do. And I said to myself inside my head, I said, "That doesn't sound right. I'm still going to try to do what I want to do to be a pilot." And so that's what I call just two choices moment. I didn't believe somebody else. I believed in myself. What kind of, is there a just two choices moment that was a turning point for you with, you know, like with Salem or even early on in the NFL that you could share with us?
You know, not really off the top of my head that I could think of, but, you know, like I said, you know, it was, you know, being at Florida State, and, I mean, we were decent back then. We weren't very good, but, you know, but being at a, you know, a major college and then, you know, ending up in Salem where, you know, I had never been that far away from home. You know, some of the guys were talking about, you know, because we had quite a few guys from Florida talking about going home. And I think what made the difference for me, Jimbo Fisher was our quarterback. And, you know, Jimbo didn't like getting hit, so he threw the ball to me a lot. and there was another guy on the team. His parents, we referred to them as mom and pop. I spent a lot of time with them, you know, eating at their house, just hanging out there. And he was, you know, they were the one that really, I guess, kept me okay with being so far away from home so I could go and get into the next level.
Mm-hmm. And so
your
you
mom,
saw
your
that.
Mom, your mom was a big...
Go ahead.
No, you got it.
So basically what I was saying is from that opportunity, once you started to perform well at Salem, did you think now you have your shot again at the NFL? Did it start to come as an aha moment for you saying, okay, now I get the second shot, I'm going to really deliver it at Salem?
Yeah, kind of that. And you know, after football season, though, I had an opportunity to stay there and finish school. Or go home and work out. And because that time of year when the scouts were coming, it was, you know, 5-6 inches of snow on the ground, you know, trying to work out for scouts in the gym really wasn't cutting it. And so I went home and I worked out at the University of Miami because I lived back in Miami then. And I worked out at the University of Miami with some of the guys there that were getting ready to go to the next level.
Gotcha.
You know, and if I ask another question here, Orson, talking about that, you know, in general, you know, the NFL scouting combine, you know, that we know today began in 1982. So that was only like 4 years before you went to the pros. And, you know, where you got that medical and you got the physical lookout and the, you know, looked at and the mental tests and stuff for that 1 week. And we know it's not a foolproof indicator. But yet at the same time, did you, based on what you're talking about in terms of working out, you had that mindset to already do well, even like in the combine as well?
Yeah, well, that combine is a whole other story. I can't remember the scout for Dallas Cowboys' name, but you know, I didn't know anything about the combine. You know, I was invited there, and you know, I really felt like a fish out of water because the majority of those guys were, you know, gold, and I was invited there. By Dallas. Dallas got me an invite, but they invited me as an offensive tackle. So, you know, I was very surprised when I got there, and they handed me a shirt, and it had OL on it, and I was like, you know, what is this? And I was really upset. I'm not sure which coach it was, but, you know, I wasn't showing up to any meeting. I was like, man, I didn't come here to be offensive lineman. I'm a tight end, and I guess one of the coaches, you know, talked to me, you know, and he said, well, you want to work out with the tight ends? He said, you know, we'll make sure that happens. So I'm going through the different drills and stuff with the tight ends, and I've got an OL on my shirt, and it was just one of those things that kind of just, you know, kept me motivated. Like, you know, when I ran the routes, I made sure I caught all the passes and my routes were crisp. One of those deals.
Mm-hmm. And you had this, and you wanted to stay your position. You definitely didn't want to play O-line, did you, Orson?
No, I didn't want to be an offensive lineman.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you get touchdowns, right? And you catch big passes,
right.
And your offense is where the glory of playing and scoring and all this stuff. You were big about blocking too, Orson. I think you paved the way in so many ways to Denver's running game, mm-hmm. and seeing that John didn't have to throw all the time. So you were a great blocker as well, weren't you, Orson?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind blocking. I just didn't want to block all the time. You know, I love catching the ball you know, running at those little DBs and seeing their eyes get wide. You know, I enjoy that as well. But, you know, I love to block, you know, but I love catching passes as well.
Well, 260 pounds, you got a lot of power coming at you. I mean, at them,
right.
When you're running.
You're one of those first those big tight ends that could catch the ball too. So that's again, you paved the way for a lot of great tight ends later on that were athletic and yet also could block. And we see that in the NFL today for sure. Now, I know, Rico, you really wanted to touch upon his relationship with family and stuff, Rico. So go ahead and that question you have.
Thanks, Neil. Yeah, Orson, your mom, it seems your mom played a real special role in your life as well in terms of helping you to stay focused. Could you share some of those thoughts and inspirations that sounds like it kind of went both ways too?
Yeah, my mom, you know, unfortunately, I didn't have a father figure in my life. My mom did her best, you know, job of trying to be father and mother, but, you know, certain things she couldn't do. But she was always out there trying. I can remember her as a little kid out there trying to throw me, you know, and I made me get like 2 pitches out of 15 to hit. But, you know, that was just my mom, whatever it took. You know, she made a lot of sacrifices in order for me to even play sports as a young kid to develop into, you know, the talent I developed into.
Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. great. And she saw how much she had to work, right, Orson, to keep you on task, especially with not having the father figure, right? Am I correct, Orson?
Yeah, I mean, there was just so many distractions and other things, you know, in the neighborhood I grew up in. You know, it was kind of like, you know, kids did what they wanted to do. You know, I was one of those kids when the street lights came on, that was my sign to get to the house. So, and then where other kids were allowed to, you know, stay out to 11, 12 at night, you know, I had to be in the house. And my mom, she did her best, you know. Like I said, you know, I was a hard-headed kid, so quite a few mistakes made growing up.
And that's boys for sure, and we all know this, especially and when opportunities play our way, we all in our lives have those times where we made the wrong decisions and wrong choices, right, Rico? For sure, we talked about that before, about my life in general and stuff.
And you know, and along those lines, I'm glad you mentioned that, Neil, because another idea that we have here with you know, with choices, we call them high vibe. You know, really, really exciting times in life. And what's some of your one or two of the most high vibe moments, you know, choice moments you felt like playing when you're playing with the Denver Broncos? Or are there just so many of them? I mean, what a spectacular, you know, three AFC champions, three Super Bowls, three. Maybe there's just too many to mention, but can you? Is there anything in particular that jumps out as a high, really, really high vibe moment for you?
Well, you know, like I said, you know, winning that AFC championship game when you know, a lot of us didn't think we would get it done. I know John had the faith, but, you know, when that ball was fumbled on the half-yard line, you know, I thought that, you know, that our deal was over and to be able to pull that game out and you know, actually in overtime, I caught a big pass. You know, right before the Steve Watson catch to for the winning field goal. So that was a big highlight. And also, you know, being MVP player of the game against the Redskins, I had a big game in that, caught a few passes. I think I had a touchdown or something like that. Can't quite remember, but those are another big moment. And not sure. You know, people ask, did you know you could make it? How did you feel about getting there? You know, I just knew that, you know, at the time there was not a lot of big guys that had the athleticism that I had that could catch the football. I never for once thought I wouldn't make it as an NFL player. But, you know, to finally break camp and, you know, officially become an NFL player, I think that was really a big moment for me as well.
It definitely seems like it. And so those moments, and I remember Mile High Stadium and how it was rocking. And, I mean, that must have been just an unbelievable experience to play at Mile High Stadium, wasn't it?
I've been other places, and you know, there's nothing like the fans at Denver. I mean, to have a, I don't know what it is now, but back then, you know, the talk was there was a 10-year waiting list to get on the waiting list for season tickets. And, you know, fast forward to me being down here with the Jaguars, and I root for them and I pull for them, and I've got a buddy of mine that played in Indianapolis named Anthony Johnson. He's the chaplain for the team. So, you know, I kind of stay in touch with them. But, you know, you can get season tickets when you want them here. To see that in Denver, I mean, you know, that's a pretty powerful deal when you change masks because Denver's playing a playoff game. So, you know, that's pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, and just the whole atmosphere of the winning atmosphere of the Broncos, I consider two of the most greatest story traditions for teams. Two of my favorites, Orson, are Steelers and the Broncos. I live in Pittsburgh, and I'm a Denver Bronco fan. When you guys play each other, I just say, I don't care. Whoever wins, wins. And I see a big matchup, Rico, Steelers-Broncos, maybe AFC Championship this year, for sure. And then we'll see what happens if Peyton's going to finally get that ring, Rico. And I'm sure Orson's thinking about that, too. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I'm excited because my boy Kubiak is the head coach now, and you know, me and him spent a lot of time together when he was the backup for Denver, and we had a lot of talks, and you know, I respect him as a player, I respect him as a coach, and you know, I'm hoping he is the right ingredients to get Denver back there and to win another Super Bowl.
Definitely, that's the big thing, and then that's the NFL every year. But it's great to see the Broncos tradition continue in so many ways, Rico. Now, Orson. Now, Orson, one question I have also is life after football. What are you currently doing, and some of the things you're trying to promote right now?
Well, you know, I work with one nonprofit. It's called Coach's Honor. A good friend of mine is the founder of it, and kind of support it. And it's basically they mentor the coaches how to model Christ. You know, I've done some public speaking, trying to do a little bit more, but it's kind of harder for me here in Jacksonville, where I'm not as well known as I am in Denver. But I spoke to quite a few area high school teams, basically volunteering to do that. My passion is to help some of these kids to see where, you know, what they do now in high school and college reflects them when they're 20 and 30. Some of the mistakes I made early on is still following me, not having the same commitment to the classroom as I did on the football field and on the baseball diamond and on the basketball court. You know, learning how to be accountable. Those are things that, you know, we didn't talk about growing up, you know, being accountable, having discipline. You know, discipline on the football field is one thing because, you know, if you don't do it right as a kid, you're going to get screamed at. And then in the NFL, you're going to get replaced, you know, if you don't have discipline and you're not where you're supposed to be at when you're supposed to be there. They find someone to replace you, but discipline off the field is also important. So those kind of things. And, you know, I got an opportunity through my buddy Anthony Johnson to speak to the rookies. I see the NFL has a lot that they're doing now to help these guys off the field. You know, when I played, it was pretty much, they told us, we're going to give you everything you need to be successful on the field. You know, off the field, that's your deal. You take care of that. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that they're investing money and millions of dollars in these young kids, and these young kids don't have the equipment or the tools to cope with life and all the stuff that comes along with it. So, you know, I've got a little job that I'm working to kind of, yeah, pay the bills. I'm working in customer service at web.com. I've been there for over a year, you know, because I have to kind of help my mom out with her bills and also with her medical that, you know, that Medicare doesn't cover. And I just recently got offered a position with the NFL doing uniform inspector.
All right. Well, fantastic.
Wow.
I'm going to keep you in my prayers with the continued. That's what they need. We absolutely need, Rico. They absolutely need that mentorship and what Orson's able to do, and talk to even the current NFL players not to make those mistakes, for sure. And Orson, the best place we can find information on you is orsonmobley.com. Am I correct?
That's correct.
All right, orsonmobley.com. And you can check out all his information there. Rico, one more question for Orson before we go.
Yeah, Orson, we're doing a quick survey. You know, here you were, you're talking about discipline on and off the field and helping the kids to deal with life and stuff. And from your perspective, how much of life do you think is choice? Like, just a percentage. 50% of life is choice, 80% of life is choice, 25%. There's no right or wrong answer. We're just kind of like doing a little survey, trying to get a feel for it. What would be your take on that?
I think probably 75% is choice, and then, you know, maybe the other 25 is the circumstance that you grew up in, how you were raised, you know, the things you did growing up, that kind of thing. But, you know, 75% is choice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Orson, thanks again for coming on the show. And, guys, take care. And it was a lot of fun having you on the program. So thanks, Rico.
Thank you, Rico.
We can find information at just2choices.com. And we also can find information on Orson at orsonmobley.com. So take care, both of you guys, okay?
All right. Thanks, Neil. Thank you, Orson.
Have a great day.
All right. Take care.
All right.
That was the Total Celebrity Show, Just Two Choices segment. Take care, guys, and we'll talk tomorrow. Good day.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show. Another great show today. You're going to go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I always like interviewing celebrities. And it's interesting, his stories. He has a lot of tremendous stories, and I might be lucky enough to have him on for the entire half hour today. So I'm excited to welcome the program. Author and musician and radio host, author of Painted Black, Greg Kinn. Greg, thanks for calling. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. How's yourself?
I'm doing fantastic, Greg. So did you ever think you'd write a book? I mean, you all the different things, a Hall of Famer that you are, inductee of Bay Area, and all these different things. Did you ever think that you'd write a book?
Yeah, you know, I've always been a writer. And even going back to junior high school, I remember having notebooks with stories in them and all kinds of, you know, weird stuff. So I guess in a way, I've always been a writer. It just hasn't been, you know, on the professional level just in the last 10 years. But yeah, I've always been a writer. I love writing.
So tell me how you got into the music business. How did it start?
This is a good story because it encompasses all the various things in my life. Well, you know, I was the morning show host for K-Fox Radio in San Francisco for 17 years. And every morning, you know, they'd have a couple of guys for me to interview. And one morning, I got to do Ringo Starr. And I asked Ringo, you know, he was getting ready to do one of his all-star Ringo tours. And I said, hey, Ringo, where did the Beatles get their music? You know, I mean, you guys didn't have radio stations. You couldn't find, you know, there wasn't import shops. So, you know, how did you find your music? You know, I said, oh, it was really hard. Like, you know, songs like Chains and Boys and stuff like that. And he said, Ringo said, we got them from people that were merchant marines that were returning from America, and they used to bring the latest records.
Right, okay.
And I said, that's brilliant. And I thought, and that was the inspiration that had my guy, Dustbin Bob. He was the inspiration for Dustbin Bob. Dustbin Bob was a guy that owned a little stand in the penny market, and he would sell the 45s that he used to get from the American merchant marines. And I asked Sir Paul the exact same question. He gave me the exact same answer. It was guys like, he knew this guy, he knew that guy, and they were all, you know, hardcore R&B fans. And that's where the actual Beatles got their covers, their cover numbers. And it put them light years ahead of a lot of the other bands that were still operating on the Merseyside scene.
Interesting, Greg. So basically what happened was you started... Once you interviewed, you said, this is something I want to do, right? It sounds like.
Yeah. And once that individual, that character started to form in my mind, mm-hmm. It was easy to eat, you know, to add more things to his resume, because really, you know, they had to get their records from somewhere. you know, and probably would have been a friend of them that, you know, would like let them borrow the records and stuff. So, yeah, it made a lot of sense, and it was a true story. True stories are always better than made up ones, don't you think?
But as a radio personality, you always told the truth, right, Greg?
Always. Always.
Always told the truth, for sure. And so, now, so basically, Greg, who would you say were the most amazing people you interviewed in your career? You already mentioned one, fantastic. But yeah,
you know, that's a good question. Because, you know, in your career, there's always going to be a couple of stinkers. Like, it's easy to say, like, who was the worst guy you did an interview with? I would say, you know, some of the guys I thought that were most were spokesmen were guys that had a tough time, but they didn't care. You know, guys like Jimmy Page was a fascinating interview because he didn't care. Yeah, he didn't care that he was sleeping with a 14-year-old girl and worshiping the devil and all this other stuff. He didn't care.
So what was your response as the host when you're interviewing him? Were you like, oh my gosh, in your brain saying, I can't believe he's just saying
this? I asked him. I said, I actually asked him, and I had like major cojones for doing this. But in the middle of the interview, I go, so Jimmy, is it true you guys were like, worshiping the devil and doing underage girls? And he goes, yeah, it was.
Did he feel upset he ever just said that in the interview? Or
no,
just
he was proud of it.
Oh, my gosh.
So now you look back on their, on their legacy, and it's just another one of the many unusual legacies that they have left us. But, hey, come on, look. Rock and roll.
Yes.
Everybody's got the same three chords. It's what you do with them.
Right. It's how you market them, the look, the feel, the whole thing in rock and roll that leads to success and having the right team together and right place, right time.
Yeah.
So let's go to something interesting. Did you ever interview Motley Crue? Did you ever get the chance to interview them?
Motley Crue, no, but I did spend an evening drinking with them in a bar.
Is that in the book?
I didn't actually interview them, but you know, I remember we were playing in L.A. and we were down at the what was the name of that place? I think it was Barney's. It was like a rock and roll bar kind of hangout, and the Romantics were there. And I've always been I like the Romantics, you know, the red leather suits, the whole thing. And I was talking to them. The guy that was in charge of the bar thought they were a gay biker gang. He says, I'm going to throw you gay biker guys out. I don't want them in here. And, you know, good that they were going, we're not gay. We're not bikers. We're just a rock and roll band. But it didn't work.
So interesting. In the book, Painted Black, is that we got the story and say, oh, all the different things. It features iconic personalities like John Lennon, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Jimi Hendrix, and much, much more. Did you get an opportunity? So you definitely did interview Jimi then, right?
Jimi Hendrix?
Yes.
No, I never got to do Jimi Hendrix, although I did talk to Noel Redding, who was real good friends with Jimi Hendrix. Shortly after Hendrix died, Noel Redding did a series of interviews, and it was very, he told that story, for instance, about being backstage at the Monterey Pop Festival, and they had a big fight who was going to go in first, the Who or Hendrix, because they were going to, you know, smash their guitars and stuff. And Buspin Bob, by the way, who just happened to be there, says, hey, let's flip a coin. And they flipped the coin, and of course, Hendrix won the coin toss. And, that's all she wrote, man. He was a legend after that concert.
And then part of the book is about the Rolling Stones. Explain that, especially the Stones. Yeah.
You know, I had written the first book, you know, basically about the Beatles. And if you were a friend of the Beatles in the early days and, you know, how that would be, especially going through all the Beatlemania and then later on when they were having threats on their lives. The Stones is a completely different place. I mean, they had death threats everywhere they went. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They were constantly on the paw. And I think that was, you know, the fact that the Stones just didn't seem to give a hoot. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Hey, we're going to play here. Go ahead, shoot us, see if we care. And, you know, they just had it. And that, I loved, you know, Keith Richards was my idol growing up because Keith was the guy, right? And I was very fortunate that usually you only have one Keith Richards in your band.
Right.
And I had four guys, four Keith Richards. I was expected to be the straight man, you know?
Well, it's amazing, Greg, as I wish we had more time. We're definitely going to have to stay in touch, maybe connect via social media and stuff, Greg. But where's the best place we can find information on you and learn more about you? Where can we go?
GregKim.com. It all begins and ends with GregKim.com. And I got a lot of stuff going on right now. You know, this new novel is out. And I've already finished the next novel at that. And we're putting together a Greg Kim documentary. That should
Fantastic.
Be exciting. So the next couple of months are going to be pretty exciting for me.
Well, definitely. And we'll have to stay in touch and let me know when those things happen, because I can tell you your documentary will be fascinating, especially just as the musician and also the talk show host and radio guy. And
interesting.
I mean, I'll have to connect with you and ask you some questions and have you back on for a longer interview, because you were a fantastic guy. Best of luck. And I hope everyone picks up the book and learns more about you. So good talking to you, Greg.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a ton, you guys. And I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Greg. Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. You're watching The Neil Haley Show and listening to The Total Celebrity Show. When we get back, another great guest. TotalTutor.net, hashtag Neil Haley Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Spotlight Show on the Total Education Network. Remember, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Well, we're getting really close to the election, and everyone is getting geared up, and I've had both surrogates from the Obama administration and Governor Romney's staff talking about specifically why they should vote for a certain candidate. Well, right now I wanted to bring on the program somebody. It's very interesting story, because we're not talking about a Democrat or a Republican here. We're talking about an independent governor, which is historical in its own sense. I want to welcome the program Governor Lincoln Chafee. Governor Chafee, thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to be in Pennsylvania.
Oh, absolutely. And all over the world as well, my network is heard, and it's really an honor to talk to you today. And specifically enough, being an independent, why you feel that it's best for us to vote for Barack Obama on Tuesday to educate us about that. First of all, before we get to that, I wanted to ask, how is Rhode Island doing after the hurricane?
We're back on our feet. We're getting back on our feet. We got hit pretty hard in the southern part of the state. But everybody's hustling back there. All the power's back on. I think we've got 100% people back on power. So we're back on our feet.
Well, that's good. And was there a lot of damage from the hurricane?
Yes, we really got pounded in our coastal areas. The power of the surf and the high winds is just unbelievable. It just completely radically changed the beach and the landscape in the southern part of the state.
Well, my prayers are out to all of Rhode Island, that they recover and are back to normalcy, hopefully soon. I know it's going to take time. I have a lot of friends in New Jersey and New York that are going through a lot of hard times as well. And it's a tough time, but especially for you to go off of leaving Rhode Island, seeing the importance of why you should campaign for Barack Obama for president. Why should we vote for him on Tuesday? What are the reasons you think?
Well, I was once a Republican, and I saw what the Republicans did to the surplus, and the Republican president, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Republican Senate, Republican House, and they took that surplus and turned it into huge deficits, which then led to the economy collapsing. And so that's why I left the party. I saw their fiscal policies and what they did to the middle class, and I just couldn't stay a Republican. That's why I'm an independent, and that's why I'm supporting President Obama. I can't imagine having the same fiscal policies come back. And when Governor Romney picked Paul Ryan as a nominee for vice president, it showed that he supported those policies, because Paul Ryan did as a House member. I was there in the U.S. Senate as a Republican watching that surplus evaporate. Just can't imagine those same fiscal policies coming back.
So you think it would just literally bring us even into more unemployment if we go on these policies and basically never get out of our economic downturn?
That's right. They just will not pay for the things they pay. That's why the deficits came back. First, it was a big, huge tax cut for the wealthy, which they didn't need. And then there was a war in Iraq, which we didn't pay for. And then there was a prescription drug benefit without any other reforms to Medicare, which I voted against all three of those, and Paul Ryan voted for all three. And that's what gave us $1 trillion deficits. They just don't want to pay for the things they buy. And that's not my kind of policies. And I just can't imagine that coming back.
And you're afraid, based on Paul Ryan being the vice president, and that's why you're out in Harrisburg right now, because basically if his policies economically are the policies of the Romney administration, if he becomes president, it could just be crippling. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yes, and Paul Ryan is here in Pennsylvania, so we're making sure that the Obama campaign is clear about getting us back on feet and protecting the middle class. And that's what I believe. That's what makes America great. That's what President Obama has stressed in his whole time in office. Build the middle class. That's what makes America great. The ability to go to higher education with tuitions that you can afford. Have Head Start programs that the government helps out. So just the wealthy don't have pre-K, a chance to go to pre-kindergarten. This is what builds the middle class. That's what I believe in. That's what President Obama believes in.
And I think you're afraid also of the Tea Party movement and the way that what they're going to do to education. Being an education talk show, I wanted to mention this to you because, again, you're in the middle being an independent. You have certain things in certain parties, but you're right down the middle in certain ways. But seeing what they're going to do to education, really, you're fearful of that. Because if the cuts happen just like our governor in Pennsylvania has done, it really could hurt the whole education system and what we've been trying to do.
Yes, I do believe that the secret to America's success for the programs, whether it was the GI Bill or Pell Grants or Head Start, it really, as you said, to make a strong educational system. Just the wealthy shouldn't be able to have that pre-K. And that's what they do. They get a head start. They can afford to go to nursery school, learn the alphabet, then pre-K, and get a head start. Or on the other end, go to higher education. And our state college system with low tuitions, it's what made America great. Now it's under siege. And just the wealthy should not have the advantage on both ends of the educational spectrum.
So
that's just wrong.
You feel education's the way we're going to get out of this bad economy, educating people, and which I agree
as
well.
It's a big part of it. And you just look at our history. That's what made this country great. A great state system, whether it's University of Minnesota, University of Alabama, or Connecticut, California, the ability for everyone to go on, get a little community college, and then on to a four-year degree.
Yes.
That's the secret.
And you're afraid that in Ryan's plan economically, he's looking to slash education across the board then?
They just don't want to pay for anything. I was there for it. I was a member of the Senate as a Republican, and they kept buying things but never paying for them. That's what brought back the deficits, and that's why we have a tough economy right now.
And so that's one of the things. So education, as I believe, is very, very important as well. And I had a roundtable discussion on my other show a couple days ago in Pittsburgh with Tom Luna, the superintendent of schools in Idaho, and also the head of the PSEA from Obama's administration, basically speaking for Obama. And I really thought that it just sounds like they want the federal government out of education. And I think they're like, the one thing I was talking to somebody in the Tea Party, and they said that all that the federal government does for education is micromanage teachers. That has got to be the most outrageous comment I've ever heard in my life, and how out of touch the Republican Party is becoming when it comes to education.
It's true. It's very true. And that's completely out of touch, because think of all the people that have been helped with Pell Grants. Millions of people across the country have made their lives better and made this country stronger because of ability to get a Pell Grant and go on and get some higher education and then be able to be a productive member of the workforce because of that higher education. And, of course, Head Start program. Why should the wealthy just be able to get that early start on education? That's just not America.
And is that one of your major things? What else are you speaking out against, especially what Paul Ryan is, Representative Ryan's proposing in the economic plan of Governor Romney if he becomes president?
Well, the economy is one thing, but also I'm fearful of what's happening with the Supreme Court. And to have Romney and Ryan come in and have possibly another appointment to the Supreme Court, and the rulings that have occurred, especially on Citizens United and the corporations taking over this country, we just have to be very, very aware that the next president could possibly get a Supreme Court. That affects us for decades and decades to come. That's a big issue for my children, I believe, and for all our children.
And so I guess also speaking out what you saw in the Senate when you were a Republican, and what I guess I really believe the Republican Party has a lot of different sectors in it, people that have different value system, different belief system. And there are certain Republicans that absolutely believe that the federal government should stay out of our lives. But imagine if the federal government completely stayed out of our lives when we're talking about something like the hurricane. If we wouldn't have had any aid at all, specifically what could have happened, especially in the city of New York City, it could have been much, much worse. And I think that's what you're talking about as well. If you slash all the different things to help people that truly need the help, especially in a tragedy like the hurricane, it could be deadly in a lot of ways and really just stop our country altogether if we keep cutting things that people need that just we just can't stop. We can't cut those things, those programs, and that's your concern.
And it's really hypocritical because they all say we're not the Republicans will talk about we don't want any federal government, but then when it hits their state, they're the first ones in line, please help us. It's, the hypocrisy is really another one of the reasons I left that party. And now with these frequent storms, the hurricane coming in late October, the whole issue of climate change has to be back on the agenda, and what we can do about addressing the human element in climate change. If there's a human element, let's address that.
And allow it to be addressed, not just throw it out the window. I mean, honestly, I'm going to say I've had experts on my show about debunking climate change and saying it is, and I've had debates on it. And it's very, very close, but you're right. We're talking October, and we're talking thinking about New York City, a hurricane in New York City. Well, we've been talking about this 20 years ago. I don't think so.
No, and I know we're in coal country, and I respect all the jobs that come with coal, but there's got to be a balance of using this great resource we have and also burning it with good, clean technology. That benefits everybody. We invent the technology that we can export around the world. Coal industry thrives, and we have a good environment. Shouldn't those all work together?
Yeah, you have to work together. You can't destroy everything altogether. And that's where, I guess, again, working across the aisle. And what's happened after 2 years as president, he basically lost the ability to even try to work with anyone. It was literally just a shutdown mode. My way or the highway, right?
Yes, that's the Republican philosophy. I was there for it under Cheney in particular, Vice President Cheney. Such an arrogance and a know-it-all attitude and a whole lot of hypocrisy. So I'm happy to be an independent, and I'm happy to be supporting President Obama.
Is there one part of President Obama's plan that you're really supporting? We talked about the economy. We talked about specifically, I guess, federal funding of different programs. There's something else, because I know that you have differences with him, because being an independent, you're not completely for what the Democrats are doing or Republicans. You're kind of in between, and you want to really work with the constituents of your district. You're not so pro-party. You're pro-people. So what would be something else that really you're supporting President Obama in his plan?
Well, women's issues, and I'm a being a Republican and being a New England Republican, I'm very much a fiscal conservative, but I'm also someone that should let live, everybody should be able to live their lives as they see fit, and some of the women's issues, some of the issues of social issues, I think let people live their lives as they see fit and leave them alone and leave me alone and just take care of the books. That's my old-fashioned approach to government.
So,
take care of the deficits and leave me alone.
Exactly. And so what would be the – because educating the people, especially looking at you were in the Republican Party, what in about a minute or a minute and a half, what would they do if they became – if they elected Mitt Romney as president? What would happen to our country? Tell us specifically what you see because you were firsthand on their side in the Republican Party with all of them working together. You see the it's the same thing as President Obama talked about, Romneysia. It's basically the entire thing that President Bush has done. What will happen to our country if this happens?
It seems as though the wealthy just have such an advantage. And to have tax cuts that favored the wealthy, to me, when they didn't need it, they're doing just fine. And then to have the Supreme Court start making decisions in favor of corporations, but that's just not the America that we want for our future. And that's what worries me most about anybody that's considering a Romney. It's the wealthy and having more and more advantages. And it's the Supreme Court decisions... that's not the America we want for our children.
So you're thinking that specifically enough that the government will be involved in things in their lives, but not in things to help them. And that I think that specifically enough, we're seeing talking points on both sides, but by having you on the show, you're giving us a middle point of view of what could happen to our country if Governor Romney's elected. One of the big things I'm frustrated about, I consider myself a conservative in certain ways, but I have learned from this process of interviewing both sides, I'm so pro-education, but I'm very, very concerned about my taxes, especially being in the middle class, upper middle class. What's going to happen to me if those tax exemptions are eliminated? My mortgage tax, things like that. You got to tell us what's going to happen before we pull that lever on Tuesday, right?
Yes, and absolutely. And on education, don't forget that these tuitions are just becoming unaffordable. And having our students graduate from college is just crippling debt. It isn't healthy. And so you're right to be talking about education and keeping these tuitions down and having Pell Grants and other ways that we all, middle class, lower middle class, upper middle class, can have a shot is critical to our success as a country.
Well, Governor Chafee, thank you again for taking the time. I'd love to have you back on later on to reach out to talk about specifically. I'll be in touch via Twitter with you, that basically to bring you on to tell us about what you're doing in education in Rhode Island, because I do have an international talk show. So thanks again for taking the time, and love to have you back. And where can we find information on President Obama's plan and everything? What's the website?
Yes, and this is a big election. It's only in a couple of days, and the future of our country and our children's future is at stake. So it's a big one. Hope everybody gets out and vote and really looks at the issues that are important, particularly education and the record that President Obama has had at building the middle class and getting us back on our feet.
Well, thanks again for calling, and love to have you back on.
Okay.
Take care now. Okay.
Hey, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was Governor Chafee. You're listening to Total Education Spotlight Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment.